it was a self-serving statement, because he didn't sit there and say nothing, no comment, whatever. And more or less what he was trying to say was, here I am trying to do my best to help this poor woman, working hard, breaking my back, trying to help her out. And, you know, I couldn't resist her. Like, you know, she was the one who seduced me. And that was his argument. It was devoid of, like, direct forensic evidence, but there was many strands of circumstantial evidence which bound together and make a rope of a case for the state.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
Killer Patrick Quirk was celebrating a Supreme Court victory this week that could potentially see him retried for the murder of Mr. Moonlight, Bobby Ryan. The Tipperary farmer who weaved a tangled web of sex, betrayal and murder was told that a warrant used to trawl searches on his computer was unlawful and that key evidence may have to be reviewed. Today, I'm talking with colleagues Niall Donald and Eamon Dillon about the Mr. Moonlight saga and another court outing for the shamed socialite Marcus Sweeney, who will hand over a controversial field to the Criminal Assets Bureau early next month. This is Crime World, a podcast show from SundayWorld.com. So let's start with Patrick Quirk and the incredible case known as Mr. Moonlight by the media. Patrick Quirk is currently serving a life sentence for the murder of Bobby Ryan, who was the DJ known as Mr. Moonlight, whose remains were taken from a sewage tank on the grounds of a farm in Brinchamore in County Tipperary. And Quirk's trial, look, was pretty sensational. I think everybody was tuning in every day to see what the latest was. It was almost like a soap opera between affairs down in rural Ireland and everything else that went on. But this week, he has won a part of his appeal, which is really, really significant. And it's going to have some ramifications.
Yeah, this case was fought tooth and nail. It was the longest serving murder trial at the time, 72 days or 15 weeks, something like that. Every inch and piece of evidence was fought over, as is his right, and his senior counsel did a great job in that sense, as did the senior counsel for the state. But every single snippet was gone for, really, between the two sides. And it was appealed previously to the Court of Appeal. He brought 52 grounds. And then it took a year for the Court of Appeal to come back. Obviously, there was so much material. They were basically going through the entire trial again, that with the three judge panel. But then he was given permission to bring two of those issues onto the Supreme Court to make a ruling. And one of those was whether or not the computer that was seized, from which a certain amount of evidence was allowed into the case, and whether that was legally seized or not by the guards. And the Supreme Court found that it was illegally seized and that they didn't get the search warrant right, because it didn't specify computer, you know, computers. It just, you know, suggested material, or, you know, there was other things mentioned. And the argument was made that this was a search then than more than just the house. They could seize the computer, but they couldn't look into it. That should have been a separate issue.
Because there was things on the computer, I mean, wasn't it, that really became a one of the headlines of the trial, in that he had on the computer, there were searches on Google for things about how long it takes a body to decompose, and searches about forensic DNA, how long it lasts. And it did form a... It was like there was many headlines, as you said, and that was one of the headline pieces.
Yeah, it was a key strand, as I think, as the state counsel put it at the time. Like it was devoid of, like, direct forensic evidence, but there was many strands of circumstantial evidence which bound together and make a rope of a case for the state. And the computer evidence was one of those strands. Now, there's going to be argument over whether that, you know, whether that was the key strand, and does the whole rope snap without that one strand, or will it stand on its own? But this evidence that was found on the computer, which has now been judged by the Supreme Court to have been seized illegally, that was fought over at the original trial. So while you know, certain aspects of, you know, the Google searches, which were key. I mean, the reaction of the jury on the day, like, you know, their faces. I mean, we're looking at the jury trying to figure out where they're reacting or not. Yeah. But we figured they were, because we felt it was, you know, when I say we, I mean, members of the media, we felt it was kind of pretty much a key moment. But there was other stuff on the computer that wasn't allowed, that the judge, the trial judge disallowed. And that included like clips of himself having sex with Mary Larry and also his wife. Because the judge felt that this would do is just put him in, make him look like, you know, not a very nice person and had no evidential value. So, and there was other clips then that were played that were kind of,
Was that a secret camera he had put in Mary Larry's? No. And maybe we should just really quickly, just for anybody who's forgotten the details, just go through what happened down there and who was who.
Well, look, it was basically, Pat Quirk was accused of murdering, Bobby Ryan, who was the boyfriend of Mary Larry, who was a woman that he had been having an affair with, who was basically his sister-in-law. Yeah. And so, like, you know, Mary Larry had been married to Martin Larry, who died of natural causes, died of cancer some years before all this. And Pat Quirk was you know, the family friend who stood in. He was married to Martin Larry's sister, Imelda. They were very close even before that. I think one of them was the best man at the other's wedding. He helped run the farm when Mary was in a really bad way following the death of her husband. She wasn't even 40. She had three young boys. You know, it was a big dairy herd. So he kind of rode in and sort of took over. But then, as we kind of found out in the trial then, he became darkly obsessed with her. And, you know, she felt that she was taken advantage of and was in this seedy affair with Quirk. So then at some, you know, it was, you know, she tried to end the affair a couple of times, and then she met Bobby Ryan, and, you know, that was an open relationship and people were quite happy.
That's where the moonlight comes from, like, because Bobby Ryan was a local DJ, kind of country music, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And he was, like, by all accounts, you know, and his whole life was gone through in great detail in the trial. But, you know, nearly everybody had a good word to say about him, and his family have spoken very much afterwards.
And he was a bright shining light for Mary Larry, from what we heard in the trial. Like, you know, she was back to herself. She loved dancing.
There was something wholesome about that relationship after the details you'd heard about her and Quirk and the sneaking around and, you know, the betrayal of his wife, Imelda, and then the sense that she was feeling that he was up to some strange stuff. And look, people in affairs and relationships, you know, everybody doesn't feel exactly the same throughout the course of a relationship, but obviously he was feeling the writing on the wall. She was trying to separate from him, and then he was doing all this kind of very strange stuff.
That's actually some of the circumstantial evidence that presumably is still going to stand. So, I mean, she basically wanted to end it. She was tired of his kind of slightly erratic behavior. Like, her burglar alarm had gone off 17 times in 2 years. So she put in a CCTV system, which is then when they noticed, they caught him by surprise. He still had a key and he went into the front door and set off the alarm. They also found him at her underwear on the washing line.
I imagine that. I wasn't going to say it.
Her solicitor wrote a letter to him saying, right, we're ending this. You're no longer leasing the farm. You can go elsewhere. And it was very shortly after that, if not within a week, that Bobby Ryan's remains were found in this overflow tank, which is about the size of a medium-sized car. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not very big. It was built by Mary Larry's father-in-law in the 70s, you know, and it was a pretty leaky thing. And it was never searched at the time because it was covered in wrapped belt haze.
He went missing.
It was 22 months from when he was last seen the morning of the 3rd of June.
Went missing shortly after this letter about the lease was sent, or his remains were found.
His remains were found. Okay. So it was basically, like, as we kind of learned so much about Pat Quirk, he was a control freak. He was a narcissist. You know, he didn't like things to be out of his control. So he wasn't prepared to go, you know, not be allowed in that land again, knowing that the remains of Bobby Ryan were there and could possibly be found at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. He didn't want that surprise. So he decided to go ahead and discover, in inverted commas, the body. But he did it. You know, he was trying to say that he put a pipe for a pump into the tank to get some water in, to mix it in with the slurry to make it easier to spread. But he was, you know, he was in good clothes. He wasn't dirty. It was the wrong time of year for spreading slurry. It was late, and he normally had a contractor do it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these are all the strands of circumstantial evidence, and and that's presumably still going to stand. So even if they decide next week that they're going to have a retrial or they're going to quash the conviction, because we don't know what's going to be decided, they have to make their legal arguments next week, so we'll know then. But presumably all these will stand. And don't forget that the Supreme Court in 2015, I think it was, made a ruling that evidence that was obtained illegally can, or, you know, once it's inadvertently and the guards are unaware, it can still be used.
And we saw that.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be the greatest hope, I'd say, for the state.
And we saw that even with in the Regency trial. So, I mean, the law is that even if it's obtained kind of illegally, if it's so broadly in the public interest that there is an argument to be made that it can be admitted. So you saw that in the Regency trial where there was recordings made outside the jurisdiction. That was accepted by the state and by the judges. But what they're saying is that there is a way to override that. And that's been a source of argument for these things. So they will go back then to make this judgment. The options would be to order a retrial to allow the conviction stand. And sometimes the Supreme Court and other courts, like, it was a jury decision, and they are more reluctant to overturn decisions made by a jury, because the juries have given their time and listened to the full case. And that will be a consideration as well. A retrial would be incredible, really. I mean, after this amount of time, it is still possible, though.
It certainly is possible. And, you know, I mean, amazingly, going way back to the 1990s, I was just researching something recently, the case of Eamon Kelly, the late Eamon Kelly, obviously the godfather of the gangland figures who mentored them and all the rest of it. But he was actually the first guy to be convicted for cocaine trafficking in Ireland in the 90s. And during his trial was actually his conviction was found to be unsafe because of this argument that blew up afterwards about some reporting that had been done between conviction and sentence. You know, that bit that we all have to talk to the lawyers about.
Yeah.
If it's before a jury, it's different. It's because of Eamon Kelly. He actually brought it all the way to the Supreme Court. The case was retried.
Yeah.
Now, exactly the same verdict came in, but the case was retried because this bit was found to be unlawful, basically.
And obviously then, if there is a retrial ordered, he will make the argument, of course, that he can't get a fair trial. I mean, that would be one of the things that
he
would
expect. He will try that as well. But I mean, again, is there precedent that somebody walks and never gets retried? There isn't.
Not on the first go around. Often what the state will do is they'll go for a retrial and then a deal will be done. There might be an admission of manslaughter or something like that. I mean, we saw that recently there was two murder trials of Nathan O'Neill in Cork Court. It was a fellow who stabbed in a nightclub, Jamie Higgins stabbed in a nightclub, and that went to two murder trials, was hung for whatever reasons. And it came up for the third time, he pleaded guilty to manslaughter. So that was done and dusted.
Is that what happened now with Brian Rattigan as well in relation to Declan Gavan?
Well, there was, and he pled guilty to manslaughter, in the aftermath.
Instead of a retrial for murder, Interesting. This is just, it was being called, our colleague Shane Phelan was calling it kind of jaw-dropping when he won this aspect of it. But as you say, there was 50 other parts of the appeal that weren't sent on to the Supreme Court. Two bits were, and this bit has come back.
Yeah, and the other one as well, which was about whether or not the state was wrong in not calling another pathologist that they'd interviewed, who had a different view of how the injuries that were found on the skeletal remains, like whether it was, whether it was a vehicle or whether it was, you know, he'd been attacked or hit with something. So but the judges found in favour of the state on that one. They rejected that appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of other circumstantial evidence. I mean, there was recordings. I mean, that was one of the most amazing bits of the trial. How did these recordings come about that were ultimately played in court?
Which recordings are you talking about now? These were,
there was a mobile phone that was left in either Mary Lowry's bedroom or presumably his own bedroom. And then, you know, one of them was actually when Mary Lowry had found another boyfriend, you know, a new boyfriend again after Bobby Ryan's death. And it was a temporary, you know, it was, again, you know, someone she met, you know, dancing, I think, in the Gleneagle Hotel in Killarney, and they got on great. And of course, they were recorded in bed reading out a Dear Linda letter from the Sunday World, well, having a laugh.
Dear Dr. Angela.
Oh, sorry, Dr. Angela.
Was it Dr.
Yeah,
Angela?
Yeah, yeah. It was Dr. Angela.
The late Dr. Angela.
It was quite.
So, yeah, this mobile phone, this recording device, they didn't realize it was there.
It was basically a mobile phone, and you could hear them, like, it was played
and
in the
Quirk
court.
Had left it.
And Quirk had left it recording in the room. The presumably, he had left it in the room because, I mean, the sound file was found on the PC seized from him, which is now being deemed illegal.
Yeah,
now, this is one that was actually allowed, and I think it was trying to show a pattern of this obsession and this kind of this mad jealousy that drove him, you know, to kill Bobby Ryan. And this is, you know, again, one of the thin strands of circumstantial evidence.
One of the things, and like, I mean, look, the Mr. Moonlight trial and the tragic victim, obviously, at the centre of it. But when the trial was on, this was one of these, similar probably to the Hutch trial, that the public just wanted it every day to know everything that happened. I mean, they were listening, they were reading, they were whatever. And from a kind of an imagery point of view, I think what stood out was that Imelda Quirk came day after day with her husband by his side. They'd get the train up often from Tipperary. At the weekends during the trial, they were seen out eating Chinese meals together. She was by his side. Do we know, is she still there?
Well, I mean, I think she did continue to stick by him anyway in the aftermath.
Yeah, she was down to visit him in Mountjoy, like shortly after the verdict was given, which in a way there was a kind of a little bit of a surprise, because on the day the verdict came back, like, he was actually the last person to find out, because, you know, we got the text, or, you know, from someone in the court saying, oh, the jury are coming back, quick, everyone go in. And there was a sudden rush back to court 13 on the top floor of the mezzanine, which was where I was standing. But I was looking down in the smoking area where Pat Quirk was standing out there with his wife and her sister. And then the whole place gone quiet, everyone gone back into court 13. I think one young barrister went sprinting down along the balcony to get in on time. I was kind of thinking, there's no rush. And the star of the show is still outside. Yeah. And next minute he reaches inside his jacket, pulls out his mobile phone, looks at it, shows it to Imelda. So that was presumably the jury are back.
Jury are back.
And anyway, they came back up and went in. So, and it's a real weird thing in Ireland. You know, people are used to kind of the American TV shows. How do you find them, Mr. You know, Chairman? Mm-hmm. And they go, guilty, Your Honor. And it's a big, hey, and high fives and all the rest of it. But in Ireland, they kind of read out, have you filled out the form? Yes. Have you ticked a box? Yes. And, you know, have you ticked the box saying guilty? Yes, I have. And it's all done in very low key. And it took a couple of seconds, like a long, like what felt like a long time for the penny to drop. Now, I heard it because I knew what to expect. Mm-hmm. But I could see by the reaction of family members, they didn't actually know what happened.
They weren't quite sure whether it was.
And then the judge says, right, we'll come back later for the victim impact. And then everyone, oh, he's been found guilty. So it was a very strange thing.
It was. I've seen that as well.
And the point I was making then was that Imelda didn't come back for the statement, the victim impact statement made by Shelley Ryan, that, you know, later on. When he was sentenced to life. So she had gone at that stage. She wasn't going to be there. And of course, he came back in. He'd been free all this time. Now he was in custody. His tie was gone. You know, he was no longer the man in control. It was the prison officers with him were.
Yeah. I mean, it was an unusual case, I think, because, you know, because of all the stuff that came out, and it really gave a sense of these things are going on in rural Ireland. Like, that was the whole thing.
I was just totally. I mean, I don't think I was alone with that being completely blown away. I don't know why you don't think.
And don't forget the money. I mean, you know, there was weekends away to lovely hotels. I mean, there was 40,000 euros being invested in CDC Contract for Difference.
But you'd be looking at, like, it going, I'm not living. I mean, this is just unreal.
However, the other side of it was, of course, Bobby Ryan's family, who have been really, really dignified, and like, I think there was a kind of a disconnect then, because you did see all these headlines. It was just so unlikely. And then when you do hear Michelle Ryan in particular, who's been the most prominent spokesperson for the Ryan family,
she's done a great job, actually, I think, to give us an insight into what her father was like.
Yeah.
And he did seem like such a lovely, kind, great heart, fun, soft man, like, you know.
And I think they've, like, you know, although the bizarre bits of the trial made the headlines, I think she really brought the humanity of the loss of her father down. And it was really, really terrible.
She was campaigning from the day he went missing. Mm. Like, she was searching Bansha Woods, like, you know, in as she said, I think herself, like, she was just in a terrible state of mind, and she was days going through the woods on her own, which I've been to, and they wouldn't be easy. Mm-hmm. Like, to once you go off the path to look around for stuff.
And the discovery of where his body was discovered, I mean, he was thrown away like a piece of rubbish.
And it tortures the family, because they don't know, was he still alive when he was put into that tank?
And it must that's be, so traumatic for
and
them.
And it must be traumatic again, this
yeah,
this
the
decision.
Idea, you know, you're hearing this and you must, it must be like, oh my God, is this guy going to just get out? Is he going to walk? Is he going to get away with it? But no, he's still convicted of murder.
Yeah.
And we wait to see what the court does with this, whether this one piece of evidence is enough. I mean, the very most they're going to do from his point of view is retrial.
Yeah.
So he'll have another go at defending himself left, yeah, right and centre. But just going back to his wife for a minute.
Yes.
Do you not find that really curious, like, that these women stand by their men and men stand by their women in, yeah, circumstances that Quirk has been, you know, his whole life has been laid bare in this court. And you're right, Eamon, he was portrayed, and he was obviously a very narcissistic, peculiar, controlling character who was sneaking around behind her back, having an affair with her sister-in-law, you know, videoing her, going in and out of the house, all that he did. It's just really unpleasant. And like that she stuck by him.
Very publicly as well. Like she didn't,
and so publicly. Yeah. And, you know, we talk about rural Ireland and these rural areas, are they actually having sex in them? But like, I mean, the idea that you have to walk around a small village still holding hands with this guy who the nation is looking at and hearing all the details of his sort of sordid life.
Yeah.
Like, I just find that extraordinary. I would personally bury my head in the sand or stick it in a press in the kitchen and not come back out. I would be just so mortified.
Well, Quirk never was, obviously he was never called to give evidence on his own behalf, but we did hear during the court interviews he gave to the guards. He was arrested twice. He was actually arrested three times. The third time, finally, when he was charged, but he was arrested twice in relation to it. And he pretty much, it was a self-serving statement, because he didn't sit there and say nothing, no comment, whatever. He did more, and more or less what he was trying to say was, here I am trying to do my best to help this poor woman, working hard, you know, breaking my back, trying to help her out. And, you know, I couldn't resist her. Like, you know, she was the one who seduced me. And that was his argument. So presumably that's, you know, that's what Imelda was hearing behind their closed doors, or, yeah, a stronger version of it.
Well, you're asking me and Eamon to explain the, yeah, psychology of women. It's certainly not my expert area. I would be happy to say, I don't know if Eamon is willing to.
Well, I mean, I might be able to help about cultures having sex, but I mean, that might be a different podcast.
But definitely the internal workings of the female mind is a mystery.
I mean,
that's
even worse. I never called anyone a culture.
Well, he's a culture. He's allowed to say it,
of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Forgot about that.
Yeah.
Total muck savage.
It's like you're allowed slag Southsiders.
Well, technically, I'm a townie, yeah, but we won't go into that.
Brilliant. So now.
Maybe next we'll do another podcast.
We'll explain that.
In Female Psychology by Eamon Dillon and Dr. Niall Donald.
In another part of the forest, somebody else slightly confused, Marcus Sweeney, has been doing podcast interviews and claiming that he was the one who brought the Criminal Assets Bureau to court. Now, that's not right, and maybe he has a lack of understanding of what's going on here. But the case against him, his company, EWM Property Holdings, and, of course, the field at the centre of it, was back in the High Court this week as well, which it ended.
Yeah, well, this is the wrap-up, or the beginning of the long wrap-up of the case, because the judgment was made last January. Judge Alex Owens, like, quite famously, I guess now, said that he was up to his oxters in organized crime. He described it as a compelling case. There was no equivocation on the part of the judge when it came to saying that the Criminal Assets Bureau had proved their case, and it was against this wealth management company, EWM, and it was down to the only asset that was left that they could seize was this field that was bought for, I think, 112,500 euro. Mm. It's, you know, not too far from Ashbourne or Dunboyne, that neck of the woods. But they did say, you know, 700,000 went through it. You know, half of that came from, you know, another company, which essentially they were from unknown sources. Yeah, something like 30,000 came from friends of his who gave him money to invest. And this is all in affidavits that were filed in the High Court. And the case wasn't defended. Like, I mean, there was nobody there representing the company in court. Certainly Marcus Sweeney didn't turn up either.
Which they'd be entitled to, wouldn't they?
I mean, absolutely, yeah.
Totally. And you're entitled to ask for free legal aid if you need it. I mean, we've seen so many of those cases.
Yeah, and that's true. And, you know, because I mean, it is a civil case. I know it's called a criminal Proceeds of Crime Act, but they are actually civil cases. And you do have to make a specific application for legal aid, and it's not even then, it's not even blanket. You might get legal aid for a forensic accountant or something to prove that your bank account wasn't doing this when the cab was saying it was, and stuff like that. So I mean, we didn't really hear any of the, if there was any counter arguments, you know, put forward by the company, of which Marcus Sweeney was the director and founder. If there was any kind of counter affidavits, we didn't hear them. They weren't put before the court. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they weren't, you know, they may have been opened behind closed doors, you know, but they weren't opened in open court. So we don't know if there was. Now, we do know in the sitting this week, it was basically, there was a consent agreement. The judge referred to that and that basically said it's going to be handed over by a date in April, 11 o'clock, I think, the 4th of April. And it was called like, it's notice to vacate. Now, it's just the terminology vacate. It doesn't mean there's necessarily anyone living in the field or there's any animals or property or whatever. And so after that, then it'll move on to the next level, like whatever that is, Section 3. So that it'll now, I mean, initially it's now frozen. So nobody can, whoever owns the field, like the company that owns the field, they can't sell it on, they can't rent it out, they can't do anything with it. So the next step now, it'll be eventually to transfer it to the Exchequer and that'll be sold off then.
Yeah,
and that takes a number of years. The legislation, I think, is, what is it, 4 years now? It used to be 7 years.
Yeah. And like, while the onus of proof is on the defendant in the criminal assets bureau cases, unlike in a criminal case when the onus of proof is on the state, you can actually you have a 7-year window, I think, in order to provide proof of how you afforded to buy that or how your company afforded to buy that, or proof against, say, the Criminal Assets Bureau have discovered in this case that some of the money that went through this EWM property holdings company and possibly into this actual field came from significant known criminals with significant convictions, and members of a group that we call the family, in particular, had dealings with Marcus Sweeney, and he had been seen and arrested in the company of two significant heroin traffickers from Turkey. But the thing is about all this, right? Like, just as Alexander Owens, the Criminal Assets Bureau cases are kind of like funny, and he's quite a nice judge because yeah. I've seen people coming in at the back of the courtroom and they really don't know what they're doing. It's probably their first time that they're having any tangle with the Criminal Assets Bureau. They meet them. Usually what happens is the Criminal Assets Bureau will target an individual that they believe to be involved in organized crime or not paying revenue. They will carry out searches and they take away whatever they will find during those searches.
Documentation normally, isn't it?
Computers, Lots of things. Sometimes they seize actual assets, jewellery in particular these days. And then they bring it all back to the office where they sort of forensically go through this and they follow the trail of money or otherwise. And during the course of this, they will meet sometimes with the officers, will meet with the individual and they will have discussions because it's civil proceedings. Again, settlement is probably of benefit to everybody, to the court's time, to whatever. And so no doubt the officers in the Criminal Assets Bureau did meet Marcus Sweeney during this course. But that's not part of the legal case.
No.
That's a kind of a meeting as you're putting together your case.
Part of the investigation.
The case is when it comes before the courts, and that's where you have to have your legal or otherwise. But I have honestly seen people coming in, and just as Alexander Owens will sort of ask them, sorry, who are you? And they'll say, and he might say to them, oh, you're a defendant in this case. Well, let me explain to you what's happening here. So it's actually quite a friendly court. I'm sure you've probably seen that yourself. I mean, a lot of the time they do have legal representation, but sometimes he'll say gently to them, I'm going to adjourn this, but I want you to go and, you know, I want you to file your returning affidavit by such and such a time. And if you need to go and get legal representation, now is the time to do it. So it's not like, I mean, there's other courts you'd go in, you're afraid to rustle your handbag because you could be turned on.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's not a criminal court. And I think sometimes the people that you mentioned that might kind of rock up themselves not having, you know, gone to a solicitor or a solicitor saying, look, that's out of my league, I'm not getting involved. They're probably more used to turning up to a district court where, you know, it's quite acceptable to, you know, to rock up without a solicitor and tell the judge, look, I didn't hit her. you know, and it's, you know, and work from there, and then say, well, look, I'm sorry, this is a very serious charge, and I might go to the circuit court. You should get, you know, legal representation.
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas, as you say, like Judge Jones will say, look, you really do need to go and speak to a solicitor. Like, you know, do you have a solicitor in what town? And says, mm-hmm. well, look, oh yes, I've heard of him. He's a very good man. You should, you know, and he will say, you really do need to get, you know, representation, because in some cases it's a family home.
Mm-hmm. I mean, normally they're people get a chance to show is how they manage to get this money together to buy an asset. I mean, isn't that's the basic of a lot of the cab cases. So people will say, I inherited 100,000 and then I bought this. So that's a lot of it.
And we saw that this week as well, like the case against Ross Browning came up again. And one of the properties, Chestnut Lodge, that was part of the Garristown compound where he built his home. And this one where his mother and her husband were living in, and the husband who wasn't part of the case, he had borrowed €40,000 from the Garda Credit Union that was used in the refurb. And the judge acknowledged that in his judgment. And like, it was one of the small wins that they had in the case. And that, you know, when the house is sold, when the property is sold, and I say, and he was very specific, it was the curtilage of the house. You know, it wasn't the back garden included, nothing like that. That 25% of the sale will go back to them. And he did the same then with the house in belonging to, that he said, you know, that was ruled, controlled by Ross Browning in Deanstown, in Finglas, that was in the name of Ian O'Hare's cousin. And he said the same. He says, I've no idea if Ross Browning ever saw that Ian O'Hare. So if the house is sold, the money goes to him.
Yeah, they hadn't proved that element of it, I suppose. And also what you have is people will come in and they will say they can't afford lawyers. So I've even seen people I do have with serious criminal convictions who are given free legal aid to defend themselves, because that's the democratic.
And people have defended themselves very famously in cab cases. I mean, sometimes well and sometimes not, but they have mounted a defence. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at that piece of land at 112 or whatever was, 1,000 was the purchase price. I mean, it's a huge amount of money for normal people. So it wasn't defended.
And you're also very much told when your court case is up and on the public lists, which can be accessed on your phone even or anywhere.
Well, I mean,
your listing is there.
I mean, cab officers have to give evidence that they've actually served the people, like, you know, at the centre of the case. Like, they have to prove that they've made, you know, efforts to contact them. Mm-hmm. And we saw that last year with the Maguire brothers. I mean, the huge lengths the guards went to, like, he just wouldn't come out of his house. And they went back 4 times. They were threatened, you know, by somebody walking out of another house. And they eventually they went back to the judge, said, we've tried this. We strongly believe he's in there. A woman who answered the door wouldn't say who she was. You know, we subsequently, you know, a local guard was able to tell her it was this person or that person. And the judge says, look, okay, you can leave the documents in a box on his doorstep and I'll deem that has served.
Exactly.
And,
I mean, obviously, Marcus Sweeney feels hard done by. We can see that in social media, and feels that things haven't been, you know, accurate or fair on him. But I suppose even beyond what we do or say as journalists, there is the judgment of the court, and that's there to be read across the many court reporters who were there and reported on it.
And I do think that, I mean, to say it's not accurate or fair is one thing, but prove that. To come back and say that, you know, it's completely inaccurate, because I actually took the case against the Criminal Assets Bureau, which is the narrative he has clearly put out there through interviews that have gone up on social media unchallenged. That is simply not true.
No.
Marcus Sweeney did not take a case against the Criminal Assets Bureau. The Criminal Assets Bureau took a case against Marcus Sweeney. A judge said in open court that he was up to his oxers in organised crime, and he has lost this and has agreed to hand over this portion of land to the state on the basis that it was identified as the proceeds of crime. They are the facts.
Yeah, and they're there to be read in wherever you want to read them.
Yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up. I mean, look, all of this is based on affidavits that, you know, were opened in court, and the judge accepted them. He said it was a compelling case. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't get any, you know, less unequivocal from a high court judge than that. I mean, there was no question that, like, there was no question of any wriggle room there. Yeah. And he was found well and truly the proceeds of crime, and that is it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's hard to be in the papers and you know, go through that, but it is what it is.
Now, just one last item we were going to just talk about this week was cocaine.
Yeah.
And the report that Irish people are the joint what? Joint
fourth. Herd, somebody I saw somebody on our Facebook page said, "Oh, we're in the Champions League positions because the top four in the Premier League go into the Champions League."
And so Ireland are there.
A bit more of an effort. We might make number one next year.
And this is in the world. And randomly, I think either Australia or the Netherlands are number one or two thereabouts. Yeah. Spain and ourselves kind of seem to be slightly random countries. But I was talking to an addiction expert this week. A podcast will go up on it over the coming weeks. I thought it was quite interesting. And he was pointing out that, we actually have this sort of bigger problem that, you know, we do have quite an interesting relationship with alcohol here. And also, you know, which is... We do. We like the crack.
Yeah.
We love a little bit of crack and we love a bit of fun and we love to be seen as party people.
Not that
people.
Type of, well, it proves that
we do like, crack we do like the other crack now as well, unfortunately.
Yes, that's the other thing, we've come to like the other
but
stuff
I mean,
as
there
well.
Is, but there is generations of addiction problems in Ireland, I suppose, is there the reality like for...
But I guess, rich. Is he talking about the use the way, and you see it, like Americans would maybe comment on this, that... that some of them, they'll go out for a night and they'll take cocaine, you know, recreationally, you know, i.e. that they're not using it every day to get out of bed and go to work. But, you know, Friday, Saturday night, so they can chat up a woman or a man, they can feel more confident. But they're not drinkers. They don't really drink much. So this is how they do it. Whereas Irish guys will go out, get hammered, and then by midnight are starting to fade a bit, which is when the coke comes in to perk them up and keep them drinking.
Which creates a substance in the body, of course.
And put you at risk of heart attack. And the problem is now that you have guys in their 50s and 60s who are doing this, you know, to keep up with the 22-year-old minor hurlers that they're coaching or whatever. Because it's across the board. It's incredible. I know people in rural Ireland who run pubs. Who've had to hire female bouncers because all the coke was being used in the ladies' toilets. They couldn't see, you know, they were able to police the men's toilets, but suddenly they realized the problem had switched. And as many women were using it as men, and it's across the board. It's from people from 18 to 65.
It is interesting, like, why do Irish people veer towards...
cocaine?
Well, or addiction in general, I think. And,
you
know... I remember. And
I don't
I'm
know
not,
what the statistics are on relation to addiction. I suppose if you end up in the addiction services,
The problem, of course, in Ireland is the addiction services.
Probably a tiny percent of users actually end up in addiction services.
And there's very few addiction services in Ireland.
Yeah.
I mean, again, like this is a huge part of the problem. Like it's all very well to say cocaine is bad, let's make it illegal and all that. But like, how do you access help in this country? If you develop a problem, like if you have private medical insurance, that's one thing. But the state don't really provide beds for treating people with addiction. It's left up to charity bodies. There's people coming off drugs, going into houses with almost no treatment and, you know, no medical intervention. So,
while we've been kind of relatively lighthearted, I suppose, talking about the recreational use among the working people or middle classes, whatever you want to put it, people who have a few bob to go out drinking and partying at the weekends. Like there is also an epidemic of crack cocaine in this country, and that it disproportionately affects, you know, the more socially deprived, you know, people who are worse off. And in a way, it's not news. Like, as I remember in 2021, there was a Dáil committee hearing and they had, I think, four different addiction councils or people involved in addiction services, all just from Talla, like not from all over Ireland, but just from Talla. And they were talking to us at that time, there was 100,000 young people they felt were at risk of, you know, being introduced to cocaine and crack cocaine. And they said there was different figures. They were talking about, you know, one person looking after one area of West Tala suggested that there was something like 30-something houses that were essentially being used as sex dens, where young women who were addicted to crack cocaine were going there to get crack cocaine, performing sexual acts. And they came up with the figure there was something like 100 of these sex dens, you know, where you know, and it was all driven by crack cocaine addiction and crack cocaine use.
And if you tally those figures with the fact that there is no... you know, there's no beds for them to go into recovery.
Yeah, it's just not easily accessible. I mean, that is just the reality.
Now, and all those other things that are going on in that world and with that world and, the fear that's used, the threats that's used against them, the kind of the criminals that are circling that vulnerability.
Yeah. I imagine you can build up a debt, you know, from cocaine use pretty quick.
And how do you pay it off if you're necessary?
Exactly,
so, I mean, a lot of it is coming from people's families, of course, or the other way that people can pay it off is continue to sell drugs. And that's the cycle that people get stuck into.
Yeah. Or find yourself driving a van with, you know, 2 million quid's worth of cocaine in it.
Like. And of course, like to bring the conversation slightly more highbrow just for a second, happen. But with all the banking stuff that's going on and the sort of the fears a little bit around the economy and, you know, what happens if there is another crash and you have all these people who have been using cocaine? You talked about the recreational, but I think the problem happens in the same way as the problem happens with people sitting at home having a drink or going out and having a drink. It starts off at the weekend and then the weekend becomes Tuesday through to, you know, to Monday or whatever. But what happens to people who are taking cocaine? Because crack is so much cheaper. And if you can't afford the real stuff anymore, if you like to call it that, you know, it's like a tenth of the price.
I mean, you have to look at young people coming before the courts with, you know, and think, is there a way, is there some route that they're being offered out of it by the state? You know, that has to be a feature of it, you know, where people come before the courts 16, 17, 18 years old, and that there should be something there to try and direct them in a different direction. And I don't think that really exists now.
No, it doesn't. But look, anyway, I'll go into that in detail with this gentleman. It's an interesting chat we had, and we'll put it up in the next couple of weeks. I suppose to finish, Eamon, you've opened my eyes completely about rural Ireland.
Is she going to have to think she should make an apology?
What is going on?
I remember people talk about
Dublin and being the hotbed of it. Is no more compared to cocaine in the toilets.
Yeah,
she's skirting the edge.
We'll bring you on the tour.
I remember when I just started in the Sunday World, there was a certain investigative editor who won't remain nameless. Had called a local village a one horse town.
Oh God, Jesus! Yeah, that was me. I ended up on Joe Duffy. Yeah.
I have to say sorry to the two horse town.
I had to say sorry to the three residents of the one horse town. No, I learned a big lesson that time. You know. I just learned a big lesson.
Well, if you remember, we had our news editor from Longford many years, John Donlan, and if you made the mistake of writing a village, he'd change it to a town.
Okay.
And it was nearly, you know, so if you wrote the village of, I don't know, Roscrea or something, it was immediately a town, obviously. The town, but then there were actual villages that would be upgraded to town just in case.
See, we need a mix of cultures and all the rest of it amongst us to keep us all in check.
Like everything in life, you need balance.
You need balance.
You may need rural sensitivity training, Nicola.
As long as everything else.
Get you down to pet a few sheep.
I actually wouldn't mind a goat. Like as a pet. I've been watching some of these people that have them on TikTok and they seem really nice. It's slightly irritating in the morning when you get up, but as are dogs. But
do you have a garden?
I do, yeah.
And well, you won't if you have a goat.
Oh, would I not? No. Well, I don't really.
They'll eat everything. It'd be like someone went through it with a scissors.
Oh, really?
So if you have a big brambly ditch you need a clearance, you tie a goat out and clear it out. Yeah.
But they seem really cute and they come over and take a little pet and everything. They're like a little sort of a.
Yeah, they're like teenagers. Really annoying.
I'm going to think about it. Right. Okay. See you next week.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.